listening to the Walk the Line podcast. Real stories of real people.
That's see, modern technology for us, mate. You know what I mean? This is fantastic. But how you getting on with the heat, by the way, Alf? This has turned into a bit of a mini heat wave over here in the UK, isn't it?
No, I'm liking it. I mean, we haven't had the greatest summer altogether, so I just thought it would be particularly vicious to wait till the kids go back to school and then show them what they could have won.
I know, right? That's what it is. Plus, I'm Scottish. I'm not a big fan of the heat. Like, the sun is my mortal enemy. You know what I mean? It's just, I look up and you bastard. To be fair, actually, I shouldn't say that. I like the sun. The sun just doesn't like me.
You know, no, I've got quite a few friends from your part of the country, and I've seen how quickly they wilt and burn in equal proportions once we reach 18 degrees C.
That's it. We go from grey to white to red
to grey,
and then fuck off. We're going back to white again. Yeah, you're not even getting to brown. Exactly. Yeah. No, not today, mate. You're going back down. Bloody Scottish national fucking jeans that we've got going on. But it's good to have you on, mate. Thanks for coming on, joining on.
Thank you.
That's great. I love having comedians on. I've always tried to get more. That's why I jumped to the chance where you kind of go in touch with us. I'm like, get in there. I love a good comedian because there's so much more. You guys, more pressure on you, sort of thing, by the way. But you're a lot better guest than my normal sort of like kind of other guests that I've had on.
Well, I hate to break your heart, but I should make it clear that I'm not a comedian.
He's not a comedian. I'm one up straight away.
I'm a comedy MC, and I'm a booker, and I'm a promoter, and I've probably spent more time on stage than most comedians anyway. Because most shows I'm on stage, you know, depending on the format of the show, 14, 16 times, 25, 30 minutes in a show. So right. I've got comedy chops, and which is why I've been able to create these courses.
Right.
I coach, but I don't ever bill myself as a comedian. I've just been up close and personal to 10,000 people who have been doing comedy, watching what does and doesn't work, and then getting on stage after them, picking up the room if it didn't go well, and resetting the room if they blew the lid off, and just kind of setting it up so the next act walks onto the stage with kind of a fair chance, you know?
Yeah. Have you ever had even not wanted to kind of jump on the stage and be the kind of comic yourself?
Well, I started running an open mic night with a friend as a hobby. I did like 8 or 9 open spots. My first one went really well. My second one was about the biggest car crash you could imagine. But I realized it really wasn't for me. There's certain kind of aspects of being a comedian. If you're serious about it and you've got ambitions, and I tend to be an all or nothing kind of person. And I realized I just didn't have that. You know, at that time, a young child, it involves traveling. But what I did have was, once I emceed the first show, is I realized I had that. I can kind of crowd control. I'm a bit more spontaneous for crowd work. I've lived a colorful life. I've got decent stories to draw on. And then when you've done that over 1,000 times, you know, you've said certain things, you know, they work. Something was spontaneous one night. You can draw on it again in the future, still giving that impression you're spontaneous. So I've got more stage time in comedy shows than most comedians, but I'm not a comedian. I'm a bit of a unicorn in this universe of stand-up.
That's it. Do you ever feel that the comedians get a little bit, kind of, they give you a little bit of stick because of that? Because it's like, kind of, because you're getting more time than them.
Not really. I mean, typically, also, I'm emceeing shows that I run, so the comedians have a reason to want to be on side with me, but I'm also giving them opportunities, whether it's stage time. I also produce a number of workshops. You know, I may not teach them myself, I teach them, but I bring in professional comedians to teach them one day workshops on character comedy, clowning. Like Dave Thompson teaches my clowning workshop. He was Tinky Winky in the Teletubbies.
Oh my God. So that guy's like royalty, isn't he?
Yes, exactly.
He's like, Jesus Christ. It's Tinky Winky. That guy's like, oh man, that's it. You've made it. As soon as you've done that.
So, you know, the fact that I've offered opportunities to comedians for like the last 13 years, I think by and large, they've got a reason to want to like me. But the fact is, I'm a good MC. You know, I keep the show running time to time. I don't play favors with people. I don't let the show overrun.
Yeah.
And I've got a policy of progressing comedians that are getting better and working hard. You know, I bring a lot to the game as far as these workshops. I've got these online courses now, beginner, advanced emceeing. I coach people. And, you know, I think 30,000 spots through We Are Funny Project have been created. That's 30,000 5-minute or headline spots between the two of them. So that's a lot of opportunity I've created for the comedians. And by and large, I think they're appreciative of that.
That's pretty special. That's pretty impressive as well. You know what I mean? They're giving obviously a lot of opportunity to a lot of people there.
Yeah, I'm proud.
You know, and it's... Yeah, like you should be. It's great. It's great. I mean, you're into like a kind of journalism before, is that right? And you kind of transferred yourself into that. I mean, What was the reason against it, more like a kind of comedy MC sort of side of things? I mean, it's an unusual thing to kind of really go into, isn't it? It's not something you go, I want to, no offense, but I don't really kind of, I want to grow up to be like an MC. But what was the transfer?
Most of the great comedians you've seen, they spend many times MCing nights because that's what helps fill them out as superior comedians. They can flex their crowd work muscles and so on and so forth. So I don't think anybody starts wanting to be an MC as such, but once they've done a bit of open mic comedy and they realise they've got professional ambitions, the wise ones recognise becoming a good MC en route is a path to that success.
That's a crazy one.
And then in regards to career change, yeah, I worked in TV principally for 13 years. My niche was film programming. I did most of the cinema-based programs in the UK, but I also did the odd, you know, reality show. I was Russell Brand's producer on the Big Brother show back in the day. I did hidden camera shows, and then I decided to set up an eco-friendly car service, the most environment-friendly car service. I was going to be a father. I thought I'd change gear a bit. All of my shows had recently sent me to the States to shoot, and I wanted to be present on the ground.
Yeah.
So I set up this eco-friendly car business, started signing up all the TV production companies that I knew and I'd worked for. I was latterly at MTV. My boss at MTV actually took early retirement, took his redundancy, and he partnered with me. And the timing for that was horrific. It was 2007 going straight into the 2008 banking crisis.
Oh, and I could relate to that one. That's I can, yeah.
Did I get you as well?
It got me big time. Because I used to be in the forces before, and I was in the RAF.
Right.
And back in the day. And then I decided, I was like, I'm going to be a big boy. I'm going to put my big boy pants on and get myself into the real world. Because I've been in there since I was 19. Mm-hmm. And then I came out, it was 2009. So it was literally, I mean, the thing is, at least you didn't really have any sort of inclination of it because it happened before, like 2007, 2008. As it was going on at the time when I left, I could have quite easily just went, I'll stay for a minute. But no, I went fucking headfirst into it. So
what did you find? It was just the jobs market was horrific?
Yeah, it was just jobs of shit. I didn't get into it. The one thing that I didn't realise, there was a lot of jobs there, but it wasn't like kind of full-time permanent ones and not the ones I wanted. So I couldn't be picky. I'd have to grab anything that was. There was a lot of, I did a lot of contract work, a lot of like kind of maternity cover or 6 month contractors.
I would have thought the RAF would have been relatively financial proof in that kind of arena. You would have been safe there for a while longer, I imagine.
So good. So we'll carry on. But sorry, but the RAF there, what was that?
So I imagine if you'd stayed in the RAF, that's the kind of profession, and I don't know if you could call it an industry, probably not, service, that you would have been immune to the vagaries of the financial markets.
When you're in there, you are. You know what I mean? Because we get looked after. That was the one main reason why I left anyways, because you didn't want to be kind of wrapped up in cotton wool. You wanted to get an experience of the real world. A lot of guys really get upset when they leave because they've been done like 20 years in the forces and they don't know what it's like outside.
Yeah, you call it city switch, I think, isn't it? When you leave the forces and you've got to deal with kind of normal today mundanities and all.
Exactly. So you don't know what rent's like. You don't know what like kind of mortgage. Well, you got rent mortgages, but you don't have to pay for anything, especially for a young single lad like me when I was like 26, 27 coming out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I've been too used to being everything paid for. And coming out was a hell of a transition, you know what I mean? And I was just like, oh, I can't. What's this? A pint costs like £6. What the hell? I'm used to getting pints cost like £1.50. I used to go out with a tenner on cam, and you can get a double rum, a double Morgan Spice rum and coke for £1.50. It was amazing.
You know, you realise you sound like an 80-year-old man at this moment.
I probably do. I do. It's the Scottish in me as well. This is it. It's the 80-year-old man, the Scottish in me. I'm just like, for fuck's sake, I can't believe I'm spending money on that. I just want to get drunk.
I've never found that to be true. You know, the stereotype of Scottish people being tight or miserly with the money. I've got a lot of Scottish friends and it just doesn't ring true at all. I don't know where that comes from.
I know. It's the old school thing, isn't it? When you, if you have a Scottish guy who drops a pound out of his pocket, you'll pick it up before it even hits the floor sort of thing. It's just that sort of mentality.
I've seen any truth. All of my Scottish friends are super generous people.
Yeah, exactly. Weird. And it's like the Welsh, suppose they don't shag sheep. And I'm like, that's just disappointing. You know what I mean?
I largely believe that my Welsh friends don't do that, but there's one or two that I could imagine.
Yeah, there's always that, because there's only a couple in your friend group. You're like, okay, you guys don't shag sheep, but I'm not sure about you, buddy. I'm going to keep an eye on it.
Do you know that's an international thing, by the way? I've kind of learned this over the years, that,
what's that?
In most regions of the world, there is one area that slags off their neighbours by dissing them with the sheep shagger thing. So like the Australians say it about the Kiwis. In Italy, they say it about the Sardinians. It's like a globally used slur to call somebody's neighbour a sheep shagger.
It's like a go-to slang. I love that. I never knew that. That's brilliant. It's like a go-to slang word, isn't it? It's like everyone shags sheep. It's like, no, you're my next door neighbour, so automatically you have relationships with sheep. So there you go.
Yeah.
I love that. That's interesting. See, and everyone says you don't learn stuff on this podcast. I tell you.
Well, if you need to learn something every day, you've learned your thing for today. We can end the interview now if you prefer.
That's it. Job done. I don't need to do anything else. I'm going to use that. I'm going to tell all my people, what my mates tomorrow. They're going to be so excited. I can't wait.
So you're asking about what I did before. So I did the TV shows. I specialised in cinema. I did most of the movie shows. I used to make documentaries, principally about celebrities or some aspect of celebrity. I made one about Metallica.
What ones did you do? Any kind of juicy ones or something like that?
Yeah, I did a Metallica one for MTV. I did Gorillaz, the band Gorillaz, MTV. I did one about Jennifer Lopez for Channel 5. I used to do a lot of the film specials, like Channel 4 Sunday mornings, T4 spot. So we do half an hour special on big film. Like I'd go and interview Peter Jackson and Jack Black and all the cast from King Kong back in the day. And then we did, which are the ones, Sunshine, the Danny Boyle film with Cillian Murphy, who's obviously gone through the roof recently. Oppenheimer. Shall We Dance? Again, Jennifer Lopez, Richard Gere. I did a whole slew of those. I did a documentary series about people who died for real during feature films being made.
Wow.
I think Brandon Lee on The Crow is probably the most famous one. But
what a film, though.
A pilot on Top Gun called Art Shaw got killed. So all sorts of stuff, but mainly film. Film was kind of my niche.
And pretty cool,
recently I've recorded, pardon me?
I said, that's pretty cool, that, to be fair. You must, is there any sort of, like, when you were doing all the kind of interviews and stuff like that, has there any been, like, kind of ones that are turned out to be, like, proper divas, and you're just like, kind of, I wish I didn't sign up to this. Can't wait to get out of the room.
No, I mean, to be fair, normally when you're doing those interviews, I'm going to the set, so I'm visiting them on set and they're engaged and there's really not ever any problems there, and there is a schedule, they need to be free soon enough. And then otherwise they do what they call junket interviews, so you'll typically go to they'll hire out a suite at, say, the Dorchester, the hotel, and then, let's say, Sylvester Stallone, he will be sat in that chair, there'll be an empty chair opposite him with cameras set up accordingly, and they wheel you in and you've got 4 minutes or 6 minutes or whatever it might be. And then as soon as you stand up, they take the tapes out, as it was back then, tapes, hand you the tapes. There'd be a camera of Sly, there'd be a camera of me or my presenter, and then we'd walk away and that was our footage to cut into the show, and then give us clips and so forth. So you can't, I mean, there were exceptions sometimes. I did a big show with Schwarzenegger. That was like an hour deep dive for his film End of Days in 1999. So we just
love that film as well. Love that film.
It's a largely forgotten film. I mean, it was the ultimate marketing thing because it was all about the millennium, Satan taking over in the 21st century.
We did a five
camera shoot in the church. We hired a church in Chelsea. It was a five camera shoot, the whole jibs and everything. And then Johnny Vaughan was the presenter of that show. So it was a good hour with Arnie and Schwarzenegger, who I'd interviewed previously. Always an entertaining guy.
I was going to say, he has been like one of those kind of out there guys, really nice and kind of, well, I wouldn't say down to earth, but he's actually nice kind of to talk to.
He is down to earth, though, that's the thing.
Is he?
Yeah.
Christ, how can it kind of be a guy that size be so down to earth? It's ridiculous, isn't it?
It's that wonderful bit of comedy from Bill Burr when he talks about, I think the bit known as the epidemic of gold digging whores, but he talks about, you know, Schwarzenegger being brought down, and he's like, you're this great man, you know, he was a world bodybuilding champion, then he became the biggest film star in the world without changing his name, then he became the governor of California, he married a Kennedy. I mean, could you be more of a high achiever than Arnold Schwarzenegger? The answer is no, you really can't. And he's the nicest, most grounded man around, and I think that's probably earned through achievement. Like, he has just shown he can win over and over again. Like, if you're embittered in some form at the end of that, there's something very wrong. I think he's learned all the hard lessons the hard way. The result is a very sorted man.
I think he's just probably doing, he's completed life right now. He's just doing side quests. That's why you see him doing all this random stuff. He's like, what can I do now? I'm just going to do this. It's like Snoop Dogg. Snoop Dogg always reminds me of someone like that. You know, I mean, he's like doing cooking shows and stuff like that now, and it's just like he does little Martha Stewart. He's doing cooking programs, and he's obviously completely off his nut because he's obviously had like a big fat spliff before he's done it.
Oh no, well, he's probably having a spliff during do it. I mean, it's amazing how Snoop has navigated his way through the world, because obviously he seems to be a hero to almost everybody.
Oh God,
but, you know, I think it's forgotten that he did a hardcore porn series of films, and I like 20 years ago he had his own porn series, and as you say, now he's working with people like Martha Stewart, who we know as like the British Celia, what's the name of the British cook lady? I think she was chairperson at Watford for a while.
Delia Smith.
Yeah, I think Martha Stewart, just to be clear, Martha Stewart's like an American Delia Smith, is that fair?
I think so, yeah. But I think she's not as mental. I think Delia Smith is, she peaks her on craziness because that girl is fucking off a nut.
Well, Martha Stewart went to prison though, didn't she? For insider trading or something.
Did she really?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That's almost the only reason I know her. I've heard her name pop up in, you know, she gets referenced in American films and TV shows. But the main thing I know about her is she did prison time for insider trading.
See, it just shows you, it doesn't matter how nice you are, you know, you can't trust anyone, you know.
I mean, I'm sure she didn't have enough money in the first place. She had to start cheating to get more.
Yeah, that's sad. That's mental, isn't it?
But greed incarnate. I don't know anything else about the woman, but I do know she's rich and she did insider trading. It strikes me that's greed.
That's greed. Straight down the middle. You're not going to get away with it.
As I say, I don't really know much about her, but I know that.
That's great. You should probably spend about 40 years and like kind of doing all this stuff, and it's just been wiped away, and she's now been like,
but
famous for going to jail.
Like you said yourself, she's working with Snoop Dogg now. So, you know, that's probably why she's working with Snoop Dogg now, I think about it.
That's probably it.
It's three credits for going down for 3 years.
That's it. But the thing is, though, I think nowadays Snoop Dogg will just work with anyone. He doesn't give a shit anymore. He does a lot of gaming stuff like that. He's on Twitch, kind of doing Call of Duty, you know, that sort of stuff now as well.
I think the world needs more Snoop Dogg. I really do. Oh, just proves that you can achieve anything whilst stoned as anything. And it's a wonderful lesson for everybody involved.
That's it. If you want to succeed in life, just take a bong before you go to a job interview, and you'll probably nail the job interview and have it. We find,
you know, you're saying that, it just reminds me of the scene from Trainspotting when he has the dab of speed before the job interview.
Oh God, that's a classic.
Which is, yeah, I just showed it to my teenage son. He was a little bit bamboozled by it.
You can't get away with that sort of shit nowadays, could you?
I think they probably could. I think it's cinema. I think cinema's still fair game. There's a lot of other territory there. You know, the complaining masses might jump on it, but I think you can probably make Trainspotting today. I think you'd have a hard time making something like Tropic Thunder. I think that's probably where the changes come.
Yes, well, Downey Jr. does blackface. No wonder. Jesus Christ, you can't get away with that now.
Liberal use of the R word, as it has now become. But when that film came out, the R word was common parlance with, you know, most people just speaking casually. It wasn't meant nastily.
Nah, of course not. But the thing is, as well, that wasn't that long ago either. Was that 2009, something like that?
Something in that region, yes, like 12, 13 years ago.
13 years ago, Jesus Christ. Makes you think, like, holy crap, how much we've moved on as a society in like 13 years, 14
years.
Yeah,
but you know, everything's been supercharged by social media. You know, you just need three people being outraged at something on Twitter or whatever the fuck they call it now, X. You know, and what that becomes is a feedback loop of one person saying something, complaining, somebody else agrees with them, somebody else agrees with them, and then the first person agrees again. And all of a sudden, the BBC are reporting, people are saying, when it's just three fuckwits who have decided that they've got an angle of, you know, virtue signaling or whatever it is. I'm really, really annoyed and bored of mainstream news organisations reporting that Dave from Basingstoke said this on Twitter. Like, Dave from Basingstoke's opinion's particularly valid. He's not an expert on the subject.
No, of course,
why the fuck are we getting Dave from Basingstoke's tweet reported in mainstream media? The answer, of course, being because it allows them to platform some divisive idea and everybody can start fucking arguing again.
Do you get any sort of, like, kind of that sort of stuff at your comedy shows and stuff like that? Do you get anyone going, like, kind of get offended by certain kind of subjects or anything like that?
Sometimes, I mean, my feeling is it's a grown-up room. People walk in, maybe not literally, but ostensibly under the premise, they walk under a sign that says comedy show. So you would assume that people would believe that the intent of the comedian, the person on stage, is to make them laugh. It's always amazed me, this was long before I was in comedy and goes to this day, how often audience members mistake what the comedian's saying on stage for necessarily what they believe, which is, the minute you just think about that, it's clear that cannot always be the case. Often it involves exaggeration and, you know, raising tension. building tension in the room and then releasing it with the punchline. That's part of the art.
Ooh.
So you do sometimes get people who are becoming outraged at it, but really grow up, it's their problem. I've staged about 10,000 people in my room,
right.
And I think maybe 4 or 5 people said things with genuine ill intent whilst on stage,
right?
Which is an incredible ratio. I mean, that's just practically negligible. It's almost nobody. Everybody else, if they did offend somebody, well, maybe somebody in the audience was just prone to be offended. Maybe they were looking for it. You know, offense is taken, not given, is a consideration.
I like that.
Sometimes, though, this is what I would say is, you know, if we want great comedians in the future, because I operate open mic rooms, I'm all about grassroots comedy. I teach beginners or people maybe a couple of years in how to move more towards the paid and pro circuit or perform at a higher level. We must understand this. If you like whoever your comedian of choice is, whether it be a Billy Connolly or a Bill Burr or Doug Stanhope, you know, Stuart Lee, whoever it might be,
yep.
If we want our comedians to tackle thorny, tricky issues, and we do, at least some of them, then what they need to be able to do is to play to the edges in open mic in the early days so they can work through ideas, find out where the line is, decide if they do or don't want to cross it, and build up their skill set so they can navigate that tricky minefield properly. So that when they proceed for years and harness their skills and develop and become better comedians, in the future, we've still got great comedians who can make us think about situations in a different way, look through a different filter and a lens. So anybody who gets offended by an open mic act can leave the room as far as I'm concerned. I will always side with the comedian on these circumstances.
That makes sense.
As I say, there's maybe 4 people over all of these 13 years who were just wrong-uns, who were trying to be dicks for the sake of being dicks. And look, I'm the MC, I'm walking straight on stage after them. I can handle that. I will deal with that. But audience members who choose to be offended, well, maybe you should go and do something else this evening then. Because these people have worked really hard. They've thought about what they want to say. They've written it down. They've edited it. They've tried to put jokes in. They've traveled across town. They've given up their night for 5 minutes on stage. If you're so goddamn fragile that you can't manage this, you should probably leave as an audience member. The act has put in the effort to merit the right to stay. You know, we can't countenance everything for fragile people.
Nah, of course not. Of course not. The thing is, as well, with this of this kind of fragileness and this woke culture, I mean, even the big comedians, you've seen Dave Chappelle get crucified with it not long ago with sort of his material.
Sorry to speak over you, but I mean, how much of the Dave Chappelle thing was real? Or how much was that? Don't get me wrong. There was a certain proportion of people who were sincerely offended. But I read the Guardian review when his last special came out. I was delayed for various reasons, being able to watch it on Netflix. So I made a point not to read any reviews as I used to when I was in the filming.
Yeah.
I used to write reviews. I know how it works. So I held off seeing any reviews, but I saved them ready so I could read them after I'd seen it. And the Guardian review, which, you know, it drives me mad at times, but it's my paper of choice. I've read it all my life. It's my go-to, obviously the left-leaning newspaper. Their review opened with the recanting of what he says in a bit where he beats up a lesbian. Okay. And they made it sound so awful and offensive in the review. And that's how they opened. It was so dishonest and insincere because I just watched the special.
Yeah.
And they left out the part that the lesbian in the lesbian bar he's in attacks him. Okay. That's where this happens. But the way they opened the review was though he was going into lesbian bars and beating up lesbians or something close to that. It was so disingenuous. It was so dishonest. Whether they were pandering to who they think their readership is or whether we're trying to add to the shitstorm, I do not know. But that's my paper. That's kind of where I lean. I'm an outright liberal, not woke, but liberal. And that newspaper was willfully, in that review, trying to mislead people that it was something other than what it was. And I've seen that time and time again. I believe live comedy exists in the room it's happening. Okay, you can take something out of context, as in you didn't hear the line before the line after, which is obviously outright context. But there's also the context of being in a comedy show. Okay, the very nature, if the Daily Mirror or somebody takes a line from a comedy show and writes it down in a font, you're not hearing the tone of voice, the delivery, the mood of the room. None of that thing's there. It can make something sound awful when in fact it was perfectly agreeable to the people in the room that night. Or maybe one person took exception. And, you know, we don't ban alcohol because a small proportion of the country have alcohol problems. et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We can't go around banning too much of comedy because a certain amount of the community is fragile. Let's be clear, comedy can be a vicious tool to attack, you know, fragile people. But most comedians that I know, that I've watched, and that's a lot, are fairly mindful of the general consensus that, you know, comedy is there to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted.
Yeah.
So if you're coming on stage and telling jokes about, you know, a mentally disabled child, that's a pretty shitty use of your superpowers and tools to attack that person. I can understand that pissing people off. It would piss me off. But if you're using those tools to mock powerful structures, whether that's the prime minister, the government, a celebrity that's acting all cocky, whatever that target might be, then it's fair game, you know? So it's about knowing who you're targeted.
Yeah, do you think a lot of comedians are now kind of changing up their material because they're at the back of their head and might, you don't want to kind of get that sort of like kind of lynch mob after them?
There's a degree of that, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, look, let me be clear. Some things needed cleaning up a little bit, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
You know, the Me Too movement had some really valid points. There were some bad fucking guys doing some nasty shit, and that needed calling out. I'm with them. But, you know, let's remind ourselves, it's comedy. I see almost every comedy performance ever comes from the right place. Yes, they may be trying to be edgy at times, but I've had my opinion changed on really quite substantial subjects more than once by a comedian giving me another way of looking at it. In many ways, they're philosophers. The best are philosophers.
Yeah. So you went from like the kind of background and the kind of MCing and all that sort of silly stuff, and it's you've already had a pretty impressive like kind of CV already, you know, from your film, then obviously the comedy stuff. But you've now kind of transitioned again into more of like kind of teaching, coaching now. Yeah. Where did this idea come from?
Well, while I was running workshops, either teaching them myself, but mainly bringing in other teachers in all sorts of aspects. I think there was about 12 or 13 aspects of comedy. So I learned a lot from those workshops. And then because I was emceeing 4 nights a week, I could take their lessons, very often doing what they said not to do. And then I would do it on stage to test the theory and find out they were always right. And then I started coaching people one-to-one. And I started teaching the emceeing workshop, the comedy storytelling workshop, Punch Up Your Stand-Up. And then obviously lockdown came, so none of my shows and none of my workshops can happen. So during that time, I recorded two workshops, one for beginner comedians. So somebody who might be thinking of giving it a go, or somebody within maybe their first year, first 100 gigs.
Yeah.
A course for them that you can buy online, that's stepping into stand-up comedy. And then I did one for MCs. And then almost 2 years since we could bring back the live shows. And so I spent a lot of time getting those back up on their feet. Got two great new MCs have taken over from me MCing while I focus on teaching. So Luke Terry and Paul Little are the resident MCs with We Are Funny Project now. And then I've spent that time, I've created a new advanced course for comedians called Stepping Forward in Stand-Up. And that's designed to take more experienced acts right the way through to where they can get more paid and pro gigs, maybe get an agent. And I've got a very particular model that I use for that. I've taken a lot of my cinematic knowledge from my film journalist, film geek years. Because I realized I was often teaching comedians saying, look, you're the world's lowest budget film director. You know, you are creating images in people's minds designed to make them laugh, to evoke imagery, to evoke an emotional response, but with jokes.
Yeah.
And then I realized that premise went an awful lot further. Every open mic comedian is their own screenwriter, leading role, producer, director, and then later they'll have to deal with hair, makeup, wardrobe, marketing, publicity, critics, reviewers, competitions, and ultimately an agent. You know, there's so much overlap between cinema and stand-up. Yeah. So this advanced course, it really gets into the detail of how to improve their performances, improve their writing, and then navigate the scene to a more professional level. And just for the record, if I may, all of my courses come with a 30-day money-back guarantee because they're that good.
And I think because they're that good, I love the confidence. I love that.
Because they're that good. It's got, because people think it would generate cookie cutter comedians telling the same jokes. But what I teach is every comedian is on stage effectively given, this is what I reckon. This is my take on the world. So while I complained about Dave from Basingstoke on Twitter being quoted by the BBC, I think this is the real version of that, where anybody who wants to have a go at comedy can have a go. They might have to wait a week or three as they book themselves onto a night like one of mine, but they fundamentally will be allowed 5 minutes on a stage, amplified, under a spotlight, the only person in the room facing that way, telling people what they reckon with jokes, with laughs. So yeah. a lot of people secretly want to have a go at it. When I tell people what I do, they often go, oh, I can never do that. I can never do comedy. I'm like, it's really not that scary. You know, nobody cares more about your performance than you. If you don't do well, nobody's going to beat you up or fire you or complain. You just got to come back and try again a bit harder. If you take some advice from like the courses I offer or my free blogs, there's loads of free blogs with good information. You know, it doesn't take long to start getting a few laughs. When you start getting a few laughs, you start feeling like a rock star. And then, you know, you may or may not want to continue with this new hobby, hanging out with this new bunch of people you found. Loads of transferable skills, public speaking, life coaching, presenting, acting, all of these things will benefit if you've got a little bit of stand-up comedy experience. You know, it's a really broad church of people. I cannot stress this enough. You know, young, old, rich, poor, black, white, British, non-British, they're all on my stage on any given show. You know, it really is.
And it's the same thing as everything, really, isn't it? It's just the more you do it, the better you get at it. You know, it's all about practice. And I think it's once you get over that sort of fear, as you mentioned before, of doing it the first time, it just becomes into that sort of, like, comes normal. You know,
yeah, I mean, I agree with you entirely. I mean, I would say for most people, the first gig isn't really that important about getting laughs. It's just about you breaking through the psychological barrier of doing it. What that will do for your self-esteem is remarkable, because most people just do not have the courage to do such a thing. They really don't. It takes a very certain person to have the courage to do it. Once you've done it once, I suggest you do it at least 4, 5, 6 times to test those jokes, tweak them, polish them, aim to get some of those laughs, and then you've got a sense of, is this for you or not? And also, as far as writing jokes goes, what you just said is absolutely right. You know, the first time is often the worst time, but that's true of almost anything. And when people are thinking of doing comedy, like, I don't know how to write a joke. I'm like, you really do. Like, you definitely have a story, a funny story that you know to tell in the pub, or if you start a new job, to endear yourself to new colleagues. And if you don't, just sit down and write down all of your firsts and worsts, your worst meal, your worst date, the worst thing anybody ever said to you, your first, losing your virginity, you know, first holiday without your parents. All of this stuff brings up funny stories and ideas and images, or you remember something funny somebody else said when you were at university or wherever, and now you can retell it as though you said it and you get the laugh. So it's not that difficult to come up with some initial material, and then once you realize you're in for the long haul and you love this, then, you know, start becoming a bit more adept at the skill set.
Same sort of thing when I say, well, with like, can I, when I started doing podcasting, because I just jumped into it. And I thought, yeah, I like to talk. I'm going to be good at this. Oh, Christ, it literally hit me like a ton of bricks straight away. And that's why I always, whenever someone says, can I listen to your podcast? I'm like, yeah, go for it. Just don't listen to the first 10 episodes or the first 20 episodes, because they are horrendous. Yeah. And I was like, I'll listen to your first one. I'm like, please don't. It is shockingly bad, because it's a skill. Same as obviously with stand-up comedy, it's a skill, and it's something you have to perfect, something you have to understand more and get used to, and then start getting into the flow of it. And then it's all about the kind of psychology about reading the person you're talking to and getting an understanding of what question's best at that point in time. A lot of quick wittedness has to kick in. And
you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, we think back as kids, you know, we didn't just first jump on our push bike and start doing wheelies down the road. We fell off again and again and again. I mean, same with walking. When we learned to walk, we fell over again and again until we could walk. Nobody picks up a guitar and can play a perfect chord. Anything that's valuable, anything that we will learn from, anything that will ultimately give us great joy, with possibly the exception of drugs, it has to be worked at, you know, and that's where the value comes from it. So whether it's you as a podcaster, or some of my friends as comedians, or some of my musician friends, none of them did well at all the first time they did it.
Nah, of course not.
And very often not the 5th and the 10th or even the 20th time. But thereafter, I'd pop around to my friend who was learning the guitar, and all of a sudden he's playing, you know, a bit of Wonderwall. I don't play the guitar. I didn't understand that's just 3 chords, you know. It doesn't take that long till you can start, you know, suddenly 3 chords gives you access to play tens of thousands of songs.
Yeah.
But it might take you 6 months to learn those 3 chords. After that, you've got a lifetime of being able to play the guitar.
Do you get a lot of people kind of dropping out quickly because of that fear, because they're not doing well in the first...
It amazes me, actually. Over the entire years I've been doing this, there's only been one incident of somebody turning up to do a gig, in this case his first gig, and between signing in with me and time to go up, he ran and he just left and he didn't do it. And I imagine that would happen semi-frequently, and it only happened once. There's a number of people who just do it a handful of times, and for whatever reason, they just go, it's not for me. Or, you know, maybe their wife or their partner's not happy with them being out, you know, 2-3 nights a week. It's quite an investment, you know, if you want to do it. You might be on stage for 5 minutes, but you are out for the evening. But yeah, I think most people, well over half people I see, I've seen over 500 people do their first ever gig over the years. And I would say easily half of them were still doing it a year later.
That's pretty impressive. That's good numbers, that. That's pretty impressive as well, yeah. Do you ever get like that? Do you get that little bit of sense of pride when you see them, like when a couple of them, they start becoming into their own, and you see them being successful, and you're like, yes, I remember that kid. I taught him how to do that. And it's just like, yeah, get on. So
I don't know how far I go with I taught him how to do that.
Oh, not at all, but you know, like, it's like you were there when it started, sort of thing.
I do take pride that I've been able to navigate some pretty awesome and in some cases famous comedians from their early days. I've been part of their story that helped get them there. But let me be clear, they only got there because of what they did. I was just a small feature at the beginning. But yeah, I've taken great pride in trying to give a little bit of extra stage time and opportunity to acts that I see with a good attitude and working hard. There's one of my favourite comedians in the country today. I think he did one of his first gigs with me, not his very first, but he got his first 10 spots, headline spot, emceeing spot and paid spot from me.
Oh, wow. You know,
I take great pride in that.
Is it mostly that your courses stuff, can they be done online now? Obviously in modern technology, or does it have to be?
Yeah, no, the three courses I have, the beginner, advanced and MC, they're pre-recorded and online, so people can study them at any time, pace or place. Once they've bought them, they own them forever. So they're designed to be done step by step. There's a session, and at the end of the session, there's a practical challenge. You should now go and do X, Y, Z. And then when you've done that, come back. It's written and produced in the idea they'll do one session a week or thereabout. But some people I know have torn into them and done it in like a weekend. But then what will happen is once they've applied some of these lessons and they've gone out to the circuit, they can come back and go, actually, session 7, when they're speaking about this particular subject, that's of relevance to me, particularly now. And they can dip back into and go, yeah, it didn't make sense 6 months ago. Now it really, really does speak to me. And so it's there for them forever. The coaching that I offer, that's live one-to-one on Zoom. But the courses are pre-recorded and, as I say, guaranteed and lifetime access.
That's pretty cool nowadays. But I think it's a great way of doing it now. But, you know, modern technology, you know, they've got this sort of like kind of virtual way of doing things. And I think it's a great way. I can imagine it opens up to a lot of people who, if you're only doing it face-to-face, where you're situated in like a North London sort of thing, it limits to who you can actually get involved with, doesn't it? So
exactly. Well, that's what I found with running these workshops over the year. I mean, the workshops I've been running, the one-day workshops I've been doing for over 10 years, but in real terms, you're probably going to have to live within the M25 to do that. I have had people flying from Norway, come from Wales, Scotland, and Ireland for them, but by and large, it's only if you live kind of in central London. The beauty of these courses is what I've figured out for myself, what I've seen does and doesn't work in the act. I've also had the privilege of learning from all of those professionals that came in and taught workshops. So, you know, it's a unique course because I'm not a comedian. I'm not an embittered failed comedian who's decided he needs to make a course. I'm this person who sat at the side of the stage watching them up close and personal, seeing what did and didn't work over a matter of years. And then I've distilled the very best of that in step-by-step sessions. As I say, so if somebody's in their first year or they've never done it, they should look at the beginners stepping into course. If somebody's, you know, been doing it for a while, I still guarantee they'll learn a huge amount from the advanced course.
Oh, that's pretty good. It opens it up to anyone because it's you always hear the odd people. It's like, I would love to do stand-up. I remember I had a girl on my podcast when I first started, Shireen, and she got to stand-up was actually quite funny because she went to a open mic comedy night and she was talking about it, and some of the people up there were pretty awful, to be fair, she was saying. And she was saying, then she had a few drinks down her neck, and she said to the guy who organized, I think it was probably the MC, is like, oh, these guys are terrible. And he went, well, why don't you go and do it? Can you do any better? And she went, yeah, go on in. So she went up on stage. Just went, go on, up on stage. And she fell in love with it straight away. She just thought the adrenaline rush that you had when I got up there. And it's just like, it was phenomenal. And I loved it. And she's carried on doing it. And she's got a really successful comedy podcast. And she's doing her own events and all that sort of stuff.
What's
now. Shireen Hussain over in Florida.
I was going to say, if she was London-based, I'm sure I would know the name. I didn't recognise the name.
She's US-based. But yeah, that was like that's a great story. That's brilliant. You know, just random drunken night out, and now you're actually like going to fall in love with it.
Well, a lot of people are getting into comedy. It's a very broad church, as I mentioned, but a lot of people who get into comedy are obviously stand-up fans, and then they watch. If you ever have to pay to get into a show, it's a pro bill. The standard is so very high. These may not be famous people from television, but trust me, by the time you're getting paid for performing comedy, you have earned the stripes. You will be bringing good stuff.
Yeah.
And most bills are 3, maybe 4 acts. If you're paying 10, 15, 20 quid for a ticket, you're going to get great value professional comedians, okay? And when comedy fans go and see these people, they tend to go, oh my God, that's amazing. I could never do that. And then you go to an open mic night,
yeah,
and you see the best people on the bill, and there are some great acts on the open mic scene. I cannot stress that enough. Some really brilliant acts. Laughs guaranteed. And they look at those and they go, I couldn't do that. But then they look at the worst people on the bill and they go, I could definitely do better than that. And that is one of the most common stories I've heard from people that emigrated in the scene, is they always felt too intimidated because they were looking at the best of the best, you know?
Yeah.
If you look at Jimi Hendrix or Slash from Guns N' Roses, you probably never can do that. But you can learn 3 chords.
I wonder why.
Play 1,000 different songs. Yeah, exactly. So I hope people don't get intimidated by watching the best. The best should be an inspiration, but not a comparison.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great way of kind of putting it, to be fair. It does really make a lot of sense when you kind of strip it down and kind of build it up from the foundations. It gets people a lot motivated, you know. I now want to go and do stand-up now, Alf. You got me motivated. Bloody hell.
Mate, I will sort you out some stage time, genuinely. You let me know if you want to give it a go. I will give you free access to my beginner's course. I will sort you out a 5-minute spot at one of my nights. And the only thing I ask is that you tell your listeners on a future podcast how you felt it went.
Oh, yeah, I'll do a whole show about it. I'll record it when I'm down there. That's a good idea.
Well, that's a very wise thing to do. I always recommend comedians record their set and then watch them listen to them back and go, shit, I thought I was going to get a laugh there and I got crickets. I need to edit that joke. And I got a laugh there and I wasn't expecting one. Why did I get a laugh? Good, I can repeat that in the future. There's my challenge for you then, Ryan. I will give you access to my beginner's course and I will give you a spot on my stage. Do you accept the challenge?
I'm up for that. I'm up for that, definitely. Definitely. Fantastic. And I'll be an advocate of it, sort of thing. And I'll jump in with 2 foot. Actually, I tell you what, I won't even dive in. I'll swan dive into this because I'm well up for that.
Forgive me if I'm being too forthright. Shall we do a follow-up podcast in the future where you can talk about how it went? And I'll
definitely. That's a great idea.
I'm saying this live on your show, and I don't want to be presumptuous, but it strikes me that there's an interesting journey and a story here of you having your first go at stand-up, and then you tell your listeners and me how it went, and then we can chat it through.
I love that idea. Yeah, let's do that. Let's get it booked in. We'll do it further than like a couple of months, so we can go through it, and we can like kind of discuss it in a bit more detail and give people hopefully give people a laugh and have a better understanding.
Well, after we've recorded this, we will agree an approximate date and then I'll tell you how to book a spot and I'll send you free access to the beginner's course, Stepping Into Stand-Up Comedy.
That's what I could do. I love that. On that bombshell, Alfie,
You're a brave host. I admire you more than ever, Ryan.
So how could people find out about your course then, mate?
Almost everything's there on the website. We are funnyproject.com. There's a long series of blogs with free information. If you sign up to the mailing list, there's a free ebook for comedians. I'm changing it soon. So depending when people hear this, they will either be able to receive 8 problems comedians run into and how to handle them as a free ebook, or it might have been changed to my recent book, which is 8 ways to turbocharge your stand-up comedy. And they're packed with clickable links to video sections from the courses. So they've got loads of info. There's clips from the courses there on the website and lots of other good stuff. It's a bit of a font of all good things for people who perform stand-up, really. Free and paid, I should stress.
Of course. Got to get the dollar bills, yo. But what I'm doing, I'll put all those all the links, all that sort of stuff in the description so guys can click on it. But yeah, guys, if you listen to it, go and click on the link. So this seems really interesting and see what you guys think. If I can actually pull off this challenge, because I think it'd be
an
interesting one, to be honest.
You've got charm and charisma. You've made me laugh during this interview. I think you'll do well. I really do.
All right. Oh, don't you just thought you buttering me up right now, aren't you? That's what you're doing. You're just trying to save me up.
No, but confidence can only but help on stage. But I meant every word I said. You honestly, ask any of the comedians in London. I never give false flattery, my friend.
Brilliant, bro. Well, Alfie, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been brilliant. And yeah, let's see if we can sort something out with this.
I look forward to seeing you for round two after you've been on the stage. Nice one, Ryan.
Cheers, buddy.